I recently listened through to the Rest is History podcast series on Martin Luther. They did five episodes looking at the life of Martin Luther. Now, I knew a little bit about Martin Luther prior to this, like a little bit from school and a little bit because he's kind of a big deal in Christian circles. So you get a little bit, but I actually didn't know loads about him. And I found it really interesting. Martin Luther was a German monk. He didn't start as a monk, he started as a lawyer. And he was in a thunderstorm and he feared for his life. He thought he was going to die. And he prayed to like some random Catholic saint. He prayed and he said, "If you rescue me from this, I will become a monk." A radical prayer. I guess you've got to be pretty scared at the point you're willing to offer a life of being a monk for your survival. So I guess he was quite scared, but he said, "I'll become a monk." And so he survived it, and true to his word, he became a monk. So he becomes this monk, and he's in the kind of church at that point. But he finds being a monk not that much fun. And he struggles with a real sense of guilt. Just struggles with guilt all through his time as a monk. He just, no matter what he does, no matter how many acts he does, no matter how he lives, he just feels guilty all the time. He feels like God doesn't love him and that he doesn't have any experience of God's love. And then he goes away to a university, a newly built university, and starts teaching there. And during his time teaching through Romans there, he comes to understand that actually the heart of Christianity is never about what a person does. Like, Christianity isn't about, have I done enough so that God will love me? Have I done enough so that God will forgive me? It's never about that. The heart of Christianity is always about Jesus, who died for us because we weren't good enough, who died for us because we couldn't do enough. And he describes this moment as the moment where this kind of weight was lifted off him. He says that he felt like he was born again, like he suddenly experienced God's love and life for the first time. And so this is kind of his story. But this puts him at odds with the church at the time, because the church at the time were doing all kinds of things. One of these things which he really annoyed Martin Luther was they were selling these things called indulgences, which were basically, give us some money and you'll get some time off purgatory. If you give us enough money, you can get 1 million years off purgatory. Then you'll only have to be there 4 million years. I don't know how purgatory works. I've never really got my head around it. But that was the thing. And Martin Luther was like, this is crazy. This idea that money can somehow pay for forgiveness, for salvation, this makes no sense. This is nowhere in the Bible. It's got nothing to do with Christianity. And so he starts publishing these unbelievably like aggressive leaflets against the church, and he starts just criticizing them everywhere. And it gets to the point where his life is very, very much in danger. So somebody who's done a similar thing a few years ago had been burnt, and he is being labelled as the number one heretic in the Western world. He is the most famous person in Germany at this point. Everybody knows about him. Everybody's reading his stuff. And anyway, it all kicks off in 1521. So 1521, this thing called the Edict of, no, not the Edict, what was it called? The Diet of Worms, which doesn't translate particularly well, but was basically a huge meeting where he was going to meet the Roman Emperor. So the Roman Emperor was going to be in this room, and he'd called Martin Luther and said, "You have to answer for all your heresies." And so he decides he's going to go. So he goes over to this place called Worms. Now, there is a very real chance that he will be executed going to this place. And there is a very real chance that if he's not executed, he'll be imprisoned. And so on his way, he starts to get increasingly nervous, and he has to stand. And they don't want him to grandstand, because he's a great grandstander, Martin Luther. He does it like better than anyone. They don't want him to grandstand. So they say to him, "You're only allowed to answer yes or no to any question." And the questions they ask him is they read him a list of everything that he's written, and they say, "Did you write these things?" To which all he's allowed to answer is yes or no. And he says yes. And then he says, "Okay, will you recant from them?" And he says, "I'm going to have to take a bit of time to think about it." So he says, "Give me a day and I'll come back tomorrow and answer your question." So he goes away And he comes back the next day and does the very thing they were hoping he wouldn't do. Grandstands par excellence. Like, literally one of the most famous speeches from the 1500s is his speech that he gives at this point, where he just goes, and basically what he says to them is, he says, if you can prove to me from the Bible that anything I've written is not true, I will recant. But if you cannot, then I will not recant, because I have to answer to God, not to the Roman Emperor. Now, this got me thinking, because Martin Luther has all kinds of problems. He gets increasingly aggressive as his life goes on, and some of what he says is truly abhorrent and unacceptable. But what it got me thinking about is, what are those things that I would be willing to risk my safety, risk even my life for? What are those things that I believe, and that I believe them so strongly, that I would be willing to stand in front of the Roman Emperor, who's quite willing to burn heretics, and say, no, I will not recant from that. I will not step away from that. I wonder for you, kind of, is there anything that would fall into that category? Anything that you would be willing to risk imprisonment, even death for? Now, the reason I wanted to start that is because that's the situation that Paul finds himself facing in this bit of Acts that we're looking at this week. So Paul is one of the earliest church planters. He used to hate Jesus. He used to imprison Christians. He even approved when a Christian was stoned to death. He was there. And so he hated Christians, but he became a Christian. He started telling everyone all about Jesus. And we're picking up the story. If you were around last week, we're picking up the story just as he leaves a place called Ephesus. He says an emotional goodbye there, and he's on his way to Jerusalem. So we're going to pick that up at the beginning of Acts 21. So if you've got a Bible, let's have a look at this together now. I'm going to read through the first kind of 16 verses. So let me read these, maybe the first 14. So after we had torn ourselves away from them, so that's that emotional goodbye from the people in Ephesus that we looked at last week. After he'd done that, we put out to sea and sailed straight to Kos. The next day we went to Rhodes, and from there to Patara. We found a ship crossing over to Phoenicia, went on board and set sail. After sighting Cyprus and passing to the south of it, we sailed on to Syria. We landed at Tyre, where our ship was to unload its cargo. We sought out the disciples there and stayed with them for 7 days. Through the Spirit, they urged Paul not to go on to Jerusalem. When it was time to leave, we left and continued on our way. All of them, including wives and children, accompanied us out of the city. And there on the beach, we knelt to pray. After saying goodbye to each other, we went aboard the ship and they returned home. We continued our voyage from Tyre and landed at Ptolemais, where we greeted the brothers and sisters and stayed with them for a day. Leaving the next day, we reached Caesarea and stayed in the house of Philip the Evangelist, one of the seven. He had four unmarried daughters who prophesied. After we had been there a number of days, a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. Coming over to us, he took Paul's belt, tied his own hands and feet with it, and said, "The Holy Spirit says, in this way the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem will bind the owner of this belt and will hand him over to the Gentiles." When we heard this, we and the people there pleaded with Paul not to go to Jerusalem. Then Paul answered, "Why are you weeping and breaking my heart? I'm ready not only to be bound, but also to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." When he would not be dissuaded, we gave up and said, "The Lord's will be done." So this is the situation we find ourselves in, those verses we've just read there. Paul is committed to going to Jerusalem. His end goal is he wants to go to Rome, because Rome is the capital of the ancient world. He wants to go there and tell people in Rome about Jesus. It seems the obvious place to go. This is where everything's happening. So I want to go to Rome. But on his way to Rome, he wants to go to Jerusalem, because that is where the church leaders mainly are. So Jesus' disciples were mainly Jews, and so they had remained in Judea and around Jerusalem. So most of the church leaders were still in Jerusalem. So he wants to go to Jerusalem. But if you think back over our time in Acts, you'll be aware that going to Jerusalem isn't like the safest idea that Paul's ever had. Like, a lot of the opposition, so a lot of the people who are looking for Paul to be beaten, who are looking for him to be imprisoned, who are even trying to kill him in these chapters we've looked at in Acts so far, they are Jewish people in those cities, because they consider Paul to be a traitor, because he himself was Jewish, who had converted to Christianity. They also consider him to be a blasphemer, someone who's teaching incorrect things about who God was. And so they're violently opposed to Paul. So going to Jerusalem is just a bad idea, because in Jerusalem is the kind of heart of the Jewish religion. It's not very safe for him. And so what happens is, Paul's friends and his companions, they tried to dissuade him from going. So imagine you had a friend, and they were determined to go somewhere that was very, very unsafe, you know, quite likely to result in imprisonment and death. You would probably try and persuade them, like, you'd probably try and persuade them not to go. So you'd be like, I don't think it's a great idea. Like, it doesn't seem particularly safe. You'd be better avoiding Jerusalem. Just go to Rome if you want to go somewhere. Like, that's where you want to go. Just skip Jerusalem. And so that's what they tried to do. And it happens twice in this passage. So it happened first in Tyre. You might have noticed that as we were reading in verse 4. They, through the Spirit, they urged Paul not to go to Jerusalem. And then it happens again later on in verse 12. When we heard this, we and the people there pleaded with Paul not to go to Jerusalem. I actually love the interaction in this section. There's a few really interesting bits in it. So one is they meet this guy called Philip. Now, Philip has already appeared in Acts. He appeared earlier on. I think it was about Acts 8 or somewhere around there. He appears, and he has a conversation with an Ethiopian, which results in him becoming a Christian. And so we've already met Philip. But what's amazing is Philip then doesn't feature again in Acts till this moment. And what's happened? Well, 20 years on, he settled down in Caesarea, and he's had four daughters. It's just a great reminder that Christian service sometimes involves individuals going and doing things like we were looking at earlier. You know, your Amy Carmichaels and people like that. But sometimes it involves the same people settling down somewhere, having some children, carrying on telling people about Jesus. It doesn't always look the same way. It doesn't even for Philip. The other thing I love about these interactions is you might have noticed the language in verse 12. When we heard this, we and the people there pleaded with Paul not to go. So that's interesting, isn't it? We. So this book, Acts, is written by Luke. So Luke is traveling with Paul at this point. And I think it's fascinating because Luke is there trying to dissuade Paul from going. So he's one of the people trying to persuade him not to go. But when Paul's like, look, I'm going, Luke still goes with him. Like, I think it's just really interesting. So it carries on being we. So verse 12, when we arrived at Jerusalem. So it's interesting, isn't it? Luke says, look, Paul, I think this is a bad idea. It doesn't seem particularly safe. You're going to get imprisoned. Like, we don't know how it's going to end. And Paul says, look, I'm going anyway. And Paul doesn't go, well, have it your way. Then I'm taking my toys home. Like, he's like, okay, if you're going, I'm going with you. I just think it's interesting. Often when people don't do the things we want them to do, or we suggest they do, we wash our hands of it. And we go, well, I've told you not to do it, nothing to do with me anymore. Whereas Luke goes, okay, I'm going to go with you. And he carries on the journey with Paul. But I suppose the real standout bit in this section is Paul, where he says that great line, I'm ready not only to be bound, but to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. You see, notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, nah, you've got it all right. You've got it all wrong. It's going to be fine. The Jews are going to love me. I'm going to have a great time. No one's going to arrest me. It's not going to be a problem. He doesn't say that. He says, I know it's dangerous, but I'm willing to face that for the sake of Jesus. Now, that was a question that most early Christians had to ask themselves. What am I willing to face for the name of Jesus? What am I willing to face to follow Jesus was a very real question for Christians in the book of Acts. You probably had to ask yourself, am I willing to, in order to follow Jesus, face the ridicule of society? Am I willing to be ostracized, to be excluded from most of the social kind of hotspots in society, no longer able to go to the temple? Excluded from lots of jobs, from lots of positions? Am I willing to be ostracized from respectable society in order to follow Jesus? That was a question that you had to ask if you were going to follow Jesus in the book of Acts. Probably you had to go a bit further than that. You had to ask, am I willing to be disowned by my family? Am I willing for my family to no longer want to have anything to do with me because I've decided to follow Jesus? That was a question that most early Christians would have had to answer. You'd have also had to ask the question, am I willing to be arrested? Lots of early Christians were arrested. It was illegal for the first 300 years to be a Christian. So am I willing to be arrested? Many Christians were killed. So you had to ask the question, am I willing to be killed in order to follow Jesus? Am I willing to be beaten? It's kind of amazing that considering that was the question they had to ask, that Christianity just kept growing. When we hear those questions, they are big questions that the early Christians had to answer. And yet, for 300 years, despite it being illegal, despite it being difficult, Christianity spread and spread and spread and spread. More and more people decided, actually, I would be willing to face those things if it meant that I got to know Jesus and I got to experience the life that he offers. Now, I don't want you to hear me wrong. I am very glad that we don't live in a society where we have to answer those kind of questions. I think we should be thankful for that. I'm very glad that it is extremely unlikely that I will face most of those consequences for following Jesus. Unlikely to be beaten or imprisoned or excluded from the vast majority of positions or places. There may be some, but the vast majority we won't be. Most of our families will not disown us. And so, in many ways, the cost of following Jesus is lower now than it was for Christians then. But there is a risk with that, right? Because when something costs less, we can sometimes value it a bit less. You know, we often have there's a direct correlation between how much something costs and how much we value it. And so as the cost of following Jesus reduces, there's a risk that our commitment to following Jesus also reduces. As we look at Paul, we see a faith in Jesus which is radical, countercultural, brave, sacrificial, committed, even in the face of danger and hardship. Like, this is a scary Christianity, but it's also exciting and meaningful. It actually means something. It's someone who actually believes something and is willing to put their money where their mouth is. I want to suggest that a sort of take it or leave it Christianity. A Christianity that's like, yeah, I'll have a bit of Jesus, seems better than the alternatives, is unlikely really to satisfy us. I don't think that's what faith in Jesus was meant to look like. I don't think it's the kind of faith we're looking for. A Christianity that is only interested for as long as the costs are low doesn't seem to me to have really taken seriously the claims that Jesus makes. Claims like he is the only way to find forgiveness. Claims like he is the only way to come to know the God who you were created to know. Claims like that you can find life both now and for eternity in knowing him. I asked you just a few minutes ago, when I finished kind of chatting on about Martin Luther, I asked you, like, what are those things for you that you believe strongly enough in to be willing to go to prison for, to be willing maybe to die for? Now, Martin Luther, he clearly believed in the authority of the Bible and the sufficiency of the work of Jesus, that you didn't need anything as well as that. He believed in that enough to risk prison and death. Paul believed that serving Jesus was worth risking imprisonment for, and so he says, even his life. So if you are a Christian here this afternoon, if you're someone who says, I follow Jesus, is that what you mean when you say those words? Do you follow Jesus like that? Do you follow Jesus in a way that Paul would recognize, in a way that Martin Luther would recognize? And if you're not a Christian here today, then I guess the question for you then is, well, what is it? What is it in your life that you've got, okay, I believe in this enough that I would be willing to be in prison for it? Like, what have you got that you believe in that strongly? Now, of course, the problem with that question is we don't really know because we're not actually in that situation. Like, I might say, look, I'd go to jail for Jesus. Or even I'd put my life on the line for Jesus, but I'm unlikely ever to have to deliver on that promise? Like, it's easy to say. You kind of don't know until you're there whether you do it or not. It might be for you that you go, oh, I'd do it for my family. Maybe that's the thing for you. Oh, for my family. I'd go to prison for my family. Or maybe it's some other cause. I'd go to prison for racial equality or, you know, whatever it is. But the fact is, we've never been tested. How do you know? Because many of us have never been tested and never will be. Well, here's the good news. The good news is that the radical call of Christianity does not limit itself to questions of personal safety. It also extends to questions of personal preference. I want to read on. Let's see what happens when Paul gets to Jerusalem. So I'm just going to read 17 down to 26. When we arrived at Jerusalem, the brothers and sisters received us warmly. The next day, Paul and the rest of us went to see James, and all the elders were present. Paul greeted them and reported in detail what God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. When they heard this, they praised God and they said to Paul, "You see, brother, how many thousands of Jews have believed, and all of them are zealous for the law. They've been informed that you teach all the Jews who live among the Gentiles to turn away from Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or live according to our customs. What shall we do? They will certainly hear that you have come, so do what we tell you. There are four men with us who have made a vow. Take these men, join in their purification rites and pay their expenses so that they can have their head shaved. Then everyone will know that there is no truth in these reports about you, but that you yourself are living in obedience to the law. As for the Gentile believers, we have written to them our decision that they should abstain from food sacrificed to idols, from blood, from the meat of strangled animals, and from sexual immorality. The next day, Paul took the men and purified himself along with them. Then he went to the temple to give notice of the date when the days of purification would end, and the offering would be made for each of them." So, Paul goes to Jerusalem. And at the beginning, it's pretty good. So he goes to Jerusalem and he starts telling them, look, this is what's been going out in Ephesus, out in Thessalonica, out in Philippi. This is what's been going on. People have been hearing about Jesus and have been coming to follow him, and churches have been planted in all these places. And they, all these people in Jerusalem are like, that's amazing. That's so great. And they're praising God for it. But then they say, hey, we've got some good news for you as well. Here in Jerusalem, thousands of Jewish people have been coming to know Jesus as well. So at the moment, they're just sharing good news stories. Let me tell you about all the great stuff that's been going out in all these cities. Oh, yeah, and we'll tell you all about all of these people who've come to know Jesus in Jerusalem. Brilliant. So they're all sharing this good news. But the issue is that they've heard some reports about Paul. And the Jewish people who've become Christians in Jerusalem, they've heard that Paul is teaching all of the Jews that he comes into contact with to turn away from Moses and stop living according to Jewish customs. So they worry that Paul is undermining what it means to be a Jew, that he's destroying their culture and their way of life. Now, it's worth saying, this is not what Paul is doing. What Paul is doing is he's simply telling non-Jewish people who come to believe in Jesus that they don't have to follow Jewish customs. That if you are not a Jew and you come to follow Jesus, you don't have to suddenly take on all the Jewish customs that they live. You don't have to take on their diet or their purification rites or any of those things. That's what Paul's been doing. But it's been slightly changed in the telling so that they're hearing that he's actually not only doing that, but also discouraging Jews and saying, you shouldn't do that, which he's not saying. They can do what they want in terms of their customs. The church leaders are fine with what Paul's doing. They've already addressed this issue in Acts 15. You can read about it if you want. We've already looked at it as a church. That's what they refer to in verse 25 when they say, as for the Gentile believers, we've already written to them. So they're saying, look, we've already dealt with this issue. There's no issue. Gentiles just need to be considerate of Jewish people and their customs when they're meeting together. So don't eat certain meats. Don't do certain behaviors when you're around Jews because it's not very considerate of them. That's how Gentile believers need to be, but they don't have to adopt Jewish cultures, customs. But they want to reassure the Jewish Christians. So they say to Paul, to show that you're not in any way looking to undermine Jewish culture, why don't you sponsor these four men who are going through this purification ritual? And why don't you participate as well? So then no one can accuse you of either being anti-Jewish people doing Jewish things or of you yourself considering yourself to be above those things. That way, everyone can see you are completely fine with Jewish Christians continuing to practice Jewish customs. Now, I just want you to think about how Paul could have responded here. It strikes me as that if Paul was a 21st century Hartlepoodlian, then he may not have responded in the same way as he does here. He could have said, but why should I? Like, why should I do that? Why should I pay for these people to do something that I don't care whether they do or not? Like, if they want to do it, fine, but they can pay for it. Why should I pay for it? And if they don't want to do it, I'm also fine with that. But I don't see why it should be down to me to pay for them to do it. And then he could have equally said, and also, why should I do it myself? Like, I'm fine if they want to do it. That's their bag. You know, if they want to do this, that's absolutely fine. But I don't see how they can require me to do it. Like, if I shouldn't be discouraging them from doing it, then how is it fine for them to encourage me to do it? Like, surely that's cutting across my personal liberties. He could have spiritualized it. He could have said, well, it'd be hypocritical for me to do it because I don't really believe that I need to. It'd just be for show. He could have said, look, I'm free in Christ, and therefore why should I do something that I don't want to? And you see, there's lots of things he could have said that would have sounded very reasonable to us. And yet he doesn't. And he just does it. He pays for these four people and he goes through it himself. And it's for one incredibly simple reason. It's actually for the same reason that he's willing to face imprisonment and even death. It's because what matters most to him is that Christ is proclaimed. He cares more about people hearing the good news of who Jesus is than he cares about his own comfort, his own safety, or as we see here, even his own preferences. It would be kind of crazy to go, hey, I'm willing to risk imprisonment and death so that people can hear about Jesus, but paying for four people to do a purification rite and having my hair shaved, it's a step too far. It'd be kind of crazy for him to do that. You see, he sees it as all the same issue. If this is what it takes for people to hear about Jesus, then fine, because that's the thing that matters. You see, at this point, we're into much more real life issues for you and I. Are we willing to let go of our freedoms, to let go of our preferences in service of Jesus? We may not be called to go to jail in following Jesus, but we may need to rearrange our schedule in order to support someone who is struggling or to prioritize meeting with God's people on Sundays or at life groups. Is that something we're willing to do, or is that a step too far? Is that too much for Jesus to ask of us? We may not be beaten for being a Christian, but we may need to risk being ridiculed or overlooked in order to speak of him. Is that something we're willing to do? Or is that too much for us? Our lives might not be in danger as a result of following Jesus, but we may need to be willing to let go of our preferences around. I mean, let me just list some. The songs we sing, the colour of walls, the chairs we buy, the language we use, the times of our services, a whole host of things just in order to bear with each other. Paul was under no obligation to do this. He could have said no, and it would have been legitimate for him to do so. But if this would help Jewish Christians keep following Jesus, he was very willing to do it. As Paul writes in one of his letters, the only important thing is that in all different places, in all different ways, Christ is being preached. That's what matters to him. Let me try and land this. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a meeting with nine church planters from across the UK. Church planters are just people who've set up new churches, a bit like we did here in Hartlepool 8 or 9 years ago. And what we were just sat around in the room, we were discussing how could we encourage more new churches to be set up in the UK. How could we get to a place where there's more churches in and around the UK so that more people can hear about Jesus? Because there are so many towns in our country, a bit like Hartlepool, where there's thousands of people and almost nobody actually telling the truths about who Jesus is as reported in the Bible. There's so many towns where that is the case. So how do we get churches into those towns? How do we get places where people can go and hear about Jesus into all these relatively large towns which have very little now? And it struck me as we were having this conversation that one of the key battles you're going to face if you're going to do this, if we're going to get churches in places where there currently aren't churches, one of the battles we're going to face is you've got to convince some people to go there and do it. Like, you can't do it if no one's going to go. We can't set up a church in Peterlee if no one's going to go to Peterlee, or in Spennymoor if no one's going to go to Spennymoor. You just can't do it. You need some people who are going to go and actually do it. You need Christians who are willing to set up a church in a place which desperately needs one. And that requires a number of things. It requires a willingness to take risks, because you don't know what the future of that church will be. You don't know how it's going to pan out. So you've got to be willing to take risks. You've also got to be willing to sacrifice. It involves people moving to new areas, being willing to sacrifice much of the comfort and security they had before. It requires commitment, a willingness to stick with something, even when there'll be really difficult times as well as some good times in it. Commitment, sacrifice, and risk-taking are pretty countercultural in the UK. And so, as Christians, anyone who here today would call themselves as a Christian, as Christians, we are going to have to take seriously the radical call of Jesus. The call which says, follow me and find life. The call which says, I left heaven and endured the cross for the joy of bringing people into my family, and now I call you on that same path. To take the path of reaching out to people with the good news. The path of sacrifice as you seek to share the gospel. The path of commitment as you keep going through hardships. Ultimately, the path of joy, as you get to be a part of God's great work of calling people who don't know him to find the hope, the life, the meaning, ultimately the very existence we were created for. Martin Luther's life was extraordinary because he took the radical call of Jesus seriously. And Paul's life was extraordinary because he took the radical call of Jesus on his life seriously. But there were also just examples of people who knew just how good the good news of Jesus was and were therefore willing to live accordingly. If you're someone here this afternoon and you don't know Jesus, you hear that and you go, seems a bit heavy, seems a bit much. If you don't know the good news of a God who loves you, who is always with you, who forgives you, who gives you meaning and purpose and a direction in your life, then the invitation from us at Grace Church is come to know him. Come follow Jesus. Taste and see that it's good. You can't really experience the goodness of knowing Jesus without tasting it. And just describing it will never do justice to it. You've got to live it. And if you do that, or if you're someone here today who's already done that, who goes, yeah, I've already come to follow Jesus, then my prayer is that you would increasingly see just how good following Jesus is. And then, like Paul, be willing to sacrifice comfort and ease, even, dare we say it, preferences in service of Jesus, and to ensure that other people are able to hear it too. Let me pray for us, and then we'll sing as we finish.